Okay. So we're here with
Yosef Leib.
And we were just talking about
The whole problem of investment in the future. Well, you started talking about the whole problem of survival as something that kills us at a certain point. I think one of the deep issues with capitalism and the deep nature of it and the deep virtue of it is how much every plan and long-term strategy is tied into the assumption that this is for the sake of survival. Because we think of survival as being something I do just in the meantime, and things we do for the sake of survival are justified because I had to get by. And the whole problem with capitalism is how much that survival sense and survival mode is identified with and used to justify every plot we make, every long-term problem we make, and wash over the impact of it, which is bound to draw resentment eventually. The more hurtful the things we do in service of that plan are, or the more hurtful the things we ignore in service of that plan are. And a classic example, and really mythic example, is in the Bible, the whole issue of how Egypt took over the world. The whole story of how Egypt was able to take control of the entire world's currency, economy, and land.
What year was this?
It's kind of hard to tell. It's sometime before something. But right after the whole narrative of Joseph being sold by his brothers. Like, what's the whole Joseph story? Is a smart kid who learns how to take advantage of a system, not for the sake of his own benefit only, but for the sake of whoever he's working for, because he's a slave. And that's the greatest power he can hope for, is being empowered by his masters to be in charge of the thing that's enriching them. It seems like he's appreciated at first by the people being enslaved for helping them. And that's part of, they say, the big criticism, the big problem of slavery is how much first you appreciate so much someone just taking care of you. Say, what happens? It's the end of the book of Exodus. So the end of the book of Genesis and the beginning before the prelude to the book of Exodus. Because in the book of Exodus, the Israelites are all slaves, more or less. And the story of how they got that way is the end of Genesis. And part of the inherent problem of Joseph. He's in charge of a lot of Egypt's economy because he invented the system by which Egypt would survive the period of famine. Right? Pharaoh has a dream, and the meaning of the dream is very clear to Pharaoh, but in a way it's not. He's looking for something to do with it. I know this bounty right now, 7 fat cows, we're doing so well, but I know one day famine's gonna come and the cows are gonna be skinny. And isn't there some way out of that wheel? Isn't there some way out of just acknowledging that this too shall pass? And that's what capitalism grew out of, in the hopes of keeping the bounty when there's times of bounty enough to tide you over in times of lack. And the great fear underlying all capitalism is that the lack would be so great one day that we would need so much to cover us in the meantime. So let's find a way to save and hoard all the wealth until that point. And the bias in being the hoarder is that you want to be in control of the moment where it gets released, how much is released, and how fast is released. Remember in the movie Ten Commandments, the great moment is Moses breaks open the granaries to feed the people more fast than he had been allowed to or allotted to. What's the big fear of communism and socialism is that there would not be a sensitivity to the need or a capacity to meet the need, and that still the people in charge would still hoard the resources. And the secret, or not so secret, tragedy of capitalism is how much that's already happening. How does Joseph give Egypt control of the world? He tells them that they could store the grain, and they should store the grain in times of bounty. That way, in the times of famine, not only will they have enough, they'll have enough for everyone else too. Very altruistic, very virtuous, by teaching you how to, hey, save for a second, able to take care of the world. So what happens in the book of Genesis is a famine happens, and people from all around the world come to Pharaoh and say, Pharaoh, we're really hungry. We need food to get by. And he says, well, sure, I'll give you food in exchange for all the money in the entire world. And they say, sure, that's great. We don't need money. We're hungry. That's a recurring theme in the Bible also, right? That's the heart of the wisdom teachings, is how much you're going to give away when you're desperate. How much everything you have you'll just give away when you're desperate. And alas, how easy it is to take advantage of that by whoever does have something in that moment. They come back a year later saying, coming for more food. And Pharaoh says, or rather Joseph says in Pharaoh's name, they come saying, we need more food. Like, sure, just give us money. So we can't. We gave you all the money in the entire world. That's okay. Just give us your land in exchange for the food, and we'll give it to you. And they're so appreciative. The Bible narrative describes them saying, oh, thank you so much. We're so glad you're doing this for us. Come back a year later, and they're saying, hey, we need some more food. So sure, just give us more land. We can't. We gave you all the money in the entire world. It's become centralized in the hands of the ones who had monopolized the resources, which theoretically could be whoever stores their own grain, but winds up being whoever has land that they can grow from. And they say, no, no problem. Just sell yourselves into slavery to us, and then we'll give you food. And they're so appreciative. Thank you so much. And that's how the Jews get sold into slavery. The same people he was trying to take care of, ostensibly, wind up being sold into the same slavery. And that's really a lesson to all the people supporting the structure now. And that's really been the main message of history, I think, to the Jews, who facilitate the acquisition and centralizing and control of wealth, is you are not, and your children are not, the ones who are going to ever see that wealth. Somebody tough is going to be in charge of it, and your kids are going to be sold in slavery also. And the whole hope, I think, of the rest of the Torah is, here's some advice for circulating the wealth right away so that it doesn't get down to that, right? Because the main message of the rest of the rules of usury, of economic circulation in the rest of the Bible, are let the poor have the corners of the field. Anything that falls down, anyone can keep. Have a sabbatical year, have a sabbatical day, have a jubilee, so that everything goes back to where it came from once in a while, where everything had circulated once in a while. Have a festival at least once a year where everyone gives away everything they have. And only through that are you going to keep it from being one guy and one family and one team in charge of everything, starving everyone to keep them from feeling like they could ever be as big. And that's somehow part of the mystery summit of now. It's part of the main reason the Bible religions are at all relevant anymore is how much these problems and these issues have been there from the very beginning of the acquisition and accretion of, and the hoarding of the grain. God help us find a way to circulate it sooner than we start dying. Cheers.
Now, here we are in a rerun of history since the beginning of recorded time. People have been reacting and responding to oppression since the beginning of forever and before. My question is, what are we missing?
Aha. I was talking to someone about this. Someone was saying, it was arguing that history is not cyclical, because things do change forever sometimes, or they seem to have changed forever sometimes. And you were saying that maybe history isn't cyclical, but it's like a spiral. Because part of the reason religions have become so irrelevant and so many of the traditional prophetic imperatives really sometimes feel so irrelevant is the degree to which the thing that was once the problem and the message that went out about once the problem sometimes really succeeds. And the thing that becomes the solution to the problem can become so overwrought and so over-circulated that it itself becomes the problem. And so much of the issue, what we're missing, is a language to describe how much has changed and what has changed and what hasn't. What the problem is today and how it ties into what the problem was has to be able to acknowledge how much difference has come into the world. I mean, one of the issues I really have so much with my religion and all the other religions is the degree to which the imperative and the word of every prophet can be the thing that holds us back from noticing what the problem is now. Because as long as we're still fighting the old fights, we're not necessarily able to catch up to what the problem is. And that's somehow so much the mystery of the responsibility of everyone relating to old narratives, is to look around and see what's going on right now and how much can all the stories I've ever heard relate to that and help resolve that and help inform people about what the dangers in their lives are now, as opposed to just cycling old fears and using old solutions to problems that are quickly shifting very fast. Because that's really the great virtue of capitalism and the great virtue of modernism and the great virtue of synchronism, is how much reaction to small problems does happen very fast when everyone's able to and motivated to quickly deal with it for the sake of their own benefit. And we do constantly need more and better languages for relating that. As much as any old narrative has become useful for relating that, yay, huzzah, and as much as the context has shifted, we really need words and ways of describing that transition. And that's really the only thing missing, you know? A language to describe what the problem is now.
But we've been repeating the same war, the same violence, the same fear, the same propaganda, the same pain, the same suffering since forever.
How much is it the same war? It's a different war. The Babylon that was, not the Babylon that is, right?
True, but the same rhetoric is still there, but different people, and it's kind of like we're in this revolving door.
But it's very different somehow. Like the people on the opposite side are not the same people. It's not the same kids. Like this coalition and that coalition, the Wall Street coalition and the People's coalitions, are a different overlord and different uprising than ever was. And I mean that in terms of who it is who is being related to. And the fact that they use the same rhetoric is more a testament to how well certain rhetoric works. I mean, how much of this model of protesting a certain way, very much like the old, does that mean that the old revolutions never worked? No, it means they worked so well that the model of how well they worked at rallying is being applied. And that's one of the great things that people are always going to do, is apply successful models.
But on the other side, if you look at the power of fear and the fear of power, but also the fear of not belonging, and that today's revolutionaries are often tomorrow's tyrants.
Sure. If they succeed.
If they succeed, then they become the oppressors.
Not always. And or...
Well, name
and
one
or,
that isn't.
All those nice wavy gravy doesn't really seem so oppressive. You build, they build a good farm, and there might be some kind of controls. Ah, but here's the great hope of every successful revolution, is that the new oppression would be a little smarter and a little more sensitive than the old one. Well, that's the main hope, that they learn something about the kind of oppressive that needs to be used in order to protect the things they like. That's the degree to which war is like art. It's always protecting something that someone prefers, and the whole problem is justifying what you prefer. Like, let's say liberal democracies are as implicated in the terrible oppression that governments use as fascist conservative ones. It's just that they really feel and make the argument that what they're protecting is nicer than what those other assholes are protecting. And that's really the greatest hope we have for any kind of government or any kind of state, even the most progressive ones, that the thing being protected by our violence, the thing being protected by our oppression, would be nice enough that we wouldn't feel so bad about it.
But maybe, I've been thinking, maybe the issue is the system itself of top-down management. Because top-down management means and serves only those at the top. And if you look at how we started out this conversation with Joseph, Joseph knew because he was one of us. He was a slave. And so he knew how to finesse the masses into believing that he was one of them. Just like most revolutionaries who have become tyrants. Because, and if you notice something, that the armies of those tyrants
are made up of us, we the people. And what do? They go out, and the police and the military, what do? They kill their own people because they have something to lose. They're afraid of losing their mortgages, maybe. I used to think that the last person on the planet, I would ask this, what do you think the last person on the planet would say? And you have a thought on that before I tell you what I come to.
What would you ask them?
I would ask them, what do you think the last person on the planet would say? And what would you say?
Well, if you're already talking to the last person on the planet, they're really excited to see you. Because
no,
there's someone else.
You're alone. You're talking to yourself.
Talking to yourself. You wonder, the first thing you'd wonder is there anyone else? That's the first thing you'd wonder. That's the thing we'd spend your life looking for, is somebody else. But the whole problem is how much the world is the opposite. We have more fertile than ever before. We have more people, and we're more aware of people's common humanity than ever before. You know, it used to be you could dismiss other people as not being human because you didn't know their language. You didn't know how deep what they're saying was.
You can still do that today.
It's harder. It's a lot harder because everyone's being translated. We're so aware of the depth of even the most alien people's cultures, and can't help it be. And can't help it be. We're only afraid of being overwhelmed and overcome. I'm not sure what you're asking, what you're saying.
I'm asking, if you were the last person on the planet, and there was nobody else, what would you say?
About how things got the way they did?
Yeah.
You'd probably remember the last time it was good, and you'd probably talk about how great it was then.
To yourself.
To yourself.
But let's say you were the last guy, because you were the one who pushed the button.
It's hard to imagine one person tolerating
being
alive.
There is a button.
Right.
You're not going to push the button if it means you're going
to
die.
You'll call your favorite people over. Say, hey, come on by. I'm about to push the button. I made a plan. Well, Noah, right? They say, what was the crime of Noah? Is that he didn't try harder to make a boat so big that everyone could fit along. He really picked and chose the people he liked best. I mean, and that's also going back to a very similar economic model. Because an ark is also for hoarding food and resources, you know? And that's so much the main model that people, because a lot of apocalypticism going by now, and the most empowered thing most people feel like they can do is just store their own resources and decide who they like. I mean, so much of why and where people can be dismissive, people in power can be dismissive of the masses, is the degree to which they have not learned or decided to like everybody, and are much more able to be afraid of other people's desire to take what's theirs and overtake their place. That's the nature of fathers, to be very aware of how much someone else, of anyone who's taken responsibility for taking care of things, to be very aware of how much anyone and everyone else would rather have it and might abuse the power they've developed. I mean, in the context of ending patterns, right? How can you end that pattern that is so essential to life as the competition between reptiles, between tyrannosauruses for permission to be and permission to rule and permission to breed and monopolize all the women and all the resources, you know? I mean, that's one of these essential Freudian terrors that I think really sits at the heart of all the social controls, is that sense of wanting to control the game so that you could make what you want be, and your preferences could be expressed. And it's a very radical thing to have a concern for other people's preferences that it's as strong as your own, or a faith in the good in their preferences, or a system for emphasizing the preferences that are helpful inside of people's hearts. That's one of the great things religions has done, right? Put very deeply into people's hearts a preference and way of installing preferences for the shared good in people's hearts. Yay for that.
Well, it has its trade-offs, and it's not as pure-hearted as one would like it to be.
Well, that's the problem. Well, it's not pure-hearted.
How religion has manipulated to their agenda.
What's not pure-hearted in religious agendas? The degree to which they're prioritizing a certain community and
right.
certain
among
and
other
certain
things. And their
what else? What else?
Their whole propaganda about their own. If so many people believe in something, how can it be wrong? So if the religious leaders are often kind of like this idiocracy called democracy at times, where big business is king, government is queen, and religion and media are the mistress. They go wherever power is.
Right. And they're welcome. And like they have a relationship set up where the wife is tolerant of it. Right?
So you have this mistress mentality of religion and media.
Uh-huh. She can't be a full bride. Business can't have two wives. That really has to keep one under wraps because it's embarrassing. And because the dynamic of the relationship would hurt if it was too openly sacramentalized. Well, this is an expression. I think a lot of the protesters are an expression of how hurt we are by the relationship and how offended we are by the handmaiden having taken over.
Well, I think of this maybe as Noah's Ark.
Except that we're not allowed to build any structures here.
But the Ark was a symbolic metaphor anyway.
What's more literal than a house, you know? What's more literal than a structure? In that case, I'm not so sure.
people build worship and they build warships.
Uh-huh.
They worship their mind and they build warships to control the mind.
Right. Religion and the crimes of defending state inherent in it still seem kind of pure-hearted to the degree that the state is identified with the people in it, to the degree that that's the case.
But only like a mirage. I don't know how genuine it is.
Aha. You can tell how genuine it is in the hearts of who, when you're talking to someone, a priest who's devoted himself to the community. And you can tell how not legitimate it is when you look in the eyes of someone who's just trying to protect their position and utterly confused their personal benefit with communal benefit.
But maybe religion and politics and nationalism and tribalism are all kind of a gang.
Except to the degree that any of those could be penetrated. But I guess that any good gang you can always join. I mean, for me, religion has always felt much more like a tool for offsetting excesses, personally, just because I felt empowered in the language. Just the same way that I'm sure someone who grew up knowing how to use business really feels like business is a great tool for establishing good in the world, you know? The degree to which gangs are great are the degree to which you really do have a way of taking care of yourself and the people you appreciate and love. And the only great hope of something better than a gang is something that you saw work better for taking care of larger people. I mean, I really do believe in the hope that religions could become better and more sensitive and more adaptable, and that they would have to if we are going to find a way of bridging the world's languages. I mean, but that's part of the Babel problem, right? To build something great enough to take care of everyone and not leave anyone out already threatens to be something that can collapse and become problematic so easily. What's a good alternative to that, you know? Anarchisms are dependent on cooperation and common language and the will towards that. And successful implementation of good anarchs really do depend on the fostering of goodwill beforehand, you know? Because otherwise, none of this would have ever happened. It always seemed funny to me in Bakunin, everything was fine until the state came along. But where did the state come from? It didn't come from nowhere. It came from someone constructing a solution to a problem that they saw for themselves and widening that solution to benefit whoever was part of their cooperative, whoever was part of their gang, part of their mob. They don't call it a mob for no reason. A mob is a collective, you know? A mob is different from the gang in that in a mob, there's a bunch of leaders. And maybe everyone's a leader in a good mob, you know?
Well, I think one of the issues I have with religion and gangs and mobs is we keep on anytime the tribalism, the issue of tribalism.
Best religions were all designed to overcome tribalism, and it didn't make them stop being bad, because they were now their wider transnational gang. But it wasn't completely universal, and the more universal it would be, the more horrible it would be, in the name of feeling justified being big enough and good enough to be everyone's god. You know,
but
that's one of the issues.
Keep in mind that sometimes things are not what they appear to be, and people have their own agendas, and their agenda often becomes. It's kind of self-defeating in many ways, because it's about, see, I believe that we're not selfish enough.
Uh-huh.
Mike.
Because if we were really selfish, we'd want everybody, we'd want everything we would want.
Uh-huh. We're not ambitious enough in our selfishness.
Right. And if we took selfishness to the furthest end, we would want to be able to share rather than be isolated. And so the richness of how we start with the king of Egypt, who owned everything. Now he lived in petrified in fear that he was going to lose something. The point I'm saying is that in a selfish, extremely selfish society, you would want everybody to have what you had so you could share with them, and you could share this joy of feeling safe and feeling comfortable and feeling like you were in a harmonious.
You would need faith that it was possible, which is something that a lot of people haven't necessarily found reason to have. Faith that everyone's collective empowerment really was better for you. Like, history has not necessarily always reinforced that clarity. In fact, it's kind of been almost the opposite. The more, let's say, an empire tried to empower the people it had conquered, the more those people would rise up and overcome the shackles, psychological or literal, of that empire. Let's say how, right. And that's really part of the issue. A lot of empires justify themselves on the basis of, this is good for everyone. We're sharing Rome, we're sharing England with all these backwards places. We're bringing peace where there was no peace before. And do they appreciate us? No. So we have to impose, for the sake of everyone. I mean, that's the main way Christendom was able to justify any of the horrible things it did. I don't think it was always only just an excuse to conquer. I think there was a very deep-seated sense of this is really better for everyone and everyone's kids.
Well, you know, it's like we live in Pax Americana.
Uh-huh. Right.
You know, peace, American style.
A pox in all our houses. Ha,
and
ha,
and
ha,
we
ha.
Happen to have a but the dynamics that I kind of feel is that maybe our biggest fear is the fear of not belonging.
Do tell.
And because we're afraid of not belonging, we're still very primary and very manipulated easily, because because it's kind of like loneliness is the fear that you're not good enough.
What could overcome the fear of not belonging? Let's say trying to belong has a history of not working, has a history of making you look like pathetic and making people not respect you. And the other, ironically, one of the biggest tools to overcoming the fear of not belonging is making your own club, is being a different kind of elitist and saying, everyone else doesn't belong because me and my friends love this. And that's generally actually seemed to have been a great tool for bridging gaps and creating respect for your sect and for your crew and for your club. I mean, when did nerds become normative and even admirable? Was only once they became their own gang, exclusive, and became hipsters instead of being nerds, you know? And then suddenly everyone was impressed enough to start to hate them in a way, but also not mind them in a way. And so let's say one of the big arguments for nationalism in the Jewish experience is the degree to which there's a sense that as long as we were trying to be acceptable and be popular in a culture that we admired, only more reviled, only more easy to take advantage of, and easy to abuse. It's a big problem in relationships also. It's the biggest problem in all relationships. The degree to which someone really feels like they have to impress the other with how good they are for the sake of keeping it together. The more people would be like really genuinely independent, but also concerned. But that's something that I don't think happens only naturally. It could have once, like any, let's say sourdough could have once happened anywhere where wild yeasts are. But once that culture has been shattered, it needs to be rebuilt somehow. I mean, and that's the great hope, I think, of what religions can be, is rebuilding the culture that should have happened naturally, rebuilding the humanity that should have happened naturally by means of stories and spaces, you know?
But maybe let's take a look at the structure of organisms and organization.
Do tell.
Organisms and organizations have a few things in common. Survival and reproduction. And they appear to come together and trust each other. Intuitively, as in your body, all the billions of cells in your body.
It's pretty amazing how that happened, right? All those like cells.
Absolutely, and many animals even come together like coral to grow together.
Although, what's the whole problem? Is in order to do that, they have to be living off something else.
But the
either,
key...
Either in a predatory way or in a parasitic way.
Not necessarily.
What's the alternative to being either predatory or parasitic?
Well, look at your body.
My body is predatory and parasitic. There's parasites living inside me that do not benefit me, that just found their way in. And I eat food that I put aside consideration for because I had a narrative myth about, A, either how important it was to eat it, or because of my religious narrative myth that I grew up with, why the food appreciates being eaten. Making me feel even more justified and whole about it.
But let's go beyond food and survival.
A great example of the problem of
organisms. It is. But think about how your body and the cells communicate to each other.
Right.
There is an element of, for lack of a better term, called trust. You have billions of cells in your body, and they trust each other.
Sure, conspiring together all the time.
Right. Now look at society. We the people can get along and trust each other, but maybe it's our top-down managers, maybe it's our leaders who are the real problem.
Hey, Gio. I don't want to interrupt your interview.
No,
what happened? I always call you and email you, and you never answer your phone.
I'll have to talk to you a little
bit. He's all busy.
No, before that.
Yeah. No, good to talk
to you.
Do you
have my number? I was worried about you.
Good to see you.
Get in touch.
Yeah, he's making sure. Yeah,
good to see you.
What's your name, dude?
Paul.
Hey, Yosef.
Hey, man. Pleasure.
Good job out here.
Where do you know this guy from?
What's that?
Where do you know this guy from?
Hey, man, we're kindreds, man. We're in media together.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I don't always dress like this, but I was at a MIT Enterprise Forum tonight.
Oh, nice.
You know, we looked at you guys from up behind that building on the 54th floor in One Chase Plaza. And actually, last week, I got him in the stock exchange and took. He's at Jim Costanzo from the.
Also part of the media.
Aaron Burr Society.
I was here day one.
And we got him on the floor of the stock exchange last week.
I used to work on the floor of the stock exchange when I was 19.
We went in last week. I got him with no ID.
And you know what the New York
I just
stock
dressed
exchange
like this.
Aha, it was fun, yeah.
Because I went to some...
you look like you're supposed to be here,
some
right.
book publishing thing, right?
You know what the New York Stock Exchange, what I learned at the New York Stock Exchange when I was 19?
What's that?
How to curse.
Oh, I learned before that.
No, because every other word was a curse word.
Oh, I see.
This was before computers.
You know what?
On the floor, it was a locker room.
I was practicing how to behave
before
better.
Only men.
Some of the most weird aggressive people I ever met were on the stock exchange people. They were just vicious.
I've been practicing how to behave better in polite company, because out of my mouth, every other word's like motherfucker this, motherfucker that. So I thought, what can I say? So I thought, what sounds like motherfucker? So I thought, Rockefeller,
right.
So I can go around, hey, Rockefeller,
right.
Rock on, Rockefeller, and instead of saying, fuck you, motherfucker,
right.
Rock
Rocky
on,
Rockefeller.
Right, there you go.
That's great.
And then I can say, hey, Rockefeller, and they don't know I'm talking to a motherfucker.
Right. You big Rockefeller.
You Rockefeller. Hey, Rockefeller. How you doing, Rockefeller?
You remember how Abby Hoffman got into the New York Stock Exchange? Because they wouldn't let him in. They said, hey, no hippies allowed. And he got on the face and said, we're not hippies, we're Jews. And then, oh, sorry, can I go right ahead?
They were like, confused for a second.
All right. Gio, I'm glad to see you, man. Yeah, really, I was really worried because I didn't hear from you.
Yeah, no, I'm kind of in my own world and I just kind of.
But that's okay. I'm glad to see you out here, man, and get capture everything, and really good, man. And good luck.
Good job. Seeing stuff.
Keep in touch.
Right, man. Thanks for mediating.
Keep in touch. Good to see you. So this guy is an old instigator.
He doesn't look so old.
No, he's a media guy, but he's also was involved in early days of what's called the namespace in the early days it was just .com, .org, .net.
That's right.
And now it's all over, and this is his doing.
Wow. Oh, he put out all the new dots?
He fought for
that's
that.
That's amazing.
Thinking that maybe he would gain some. And then he started a very interesting thing of wireless connectivity in communities like the East Village.
Huh, what's his name?
Paul Guerin. And he also used is a pretty interesting media innovator in terms of technology.
Wow.
But
okay, it's getting late. I have to get rolling. My mom's waiting for me.
Okay, just to wrap this up.
Sure.
Organisms
and how they cooperate and how they can cooperate. But your point has been good. The eternal problem is once they successfully cooperate, they're cooperating against everyone else.
Or
to some degree, to eat. They have to eat something, and part of collaboration and conspiracy is part of the fear of it. Is the knowledge that collaboration of two is always, I don't know. It's not necessarily always at the expense of someone else, but it tends to be. It tends to be us against the world a little bit, and breaking that cycle is a very deep and profound mystery. Because what else are we going to eat? Who are we going to take advantage of? If not all the other people, you know?
This is an interesting...
if not the people, then the cows. If not the cows, then the vegetables.
The
and if not the land, then we're going to have to find something else that we feel comfortable exploiting or living from. And that's some kind of very profound social mystery.
Ah, that's beautiful.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah.
What's your name?
Yosef.
Yosef Chelsea. Nice to meet you. Yeah, how about you?
What does it mean to occupy your soul?
Gio, and what does it mean to occupy your soul to you?
Well, I think that we live in a society now, especially what we're occupying against here, that sort of fakes their way through spirituality and doesn't feel it in a real, true way. It doesn't come from a place of peace and hope and love. It doesn't come from love, it comes from fear. A lot of our spirituality is fear-based, and we're kept from our truth with fear. And I think that as much as this revolution needs to be one of economics, policy, political realm, it needs to be in a spiritual realm as well. And we need to reclaim what has been taken from us with fear manipulation and with our own ignorance and our own distractions from what's truly in our souls and in our hearts. So
you're advocating what?
Oh, let's see. I'm advocating that everyone reclaim their spirituality and their souls and to figure out what they love and not have anybody else tell them. And I guess to search, to never stop looking, and to never think they know the real truth, because the truth doesn't just exist as one thing. You have to travel toward it. And you always have to be traveling toward it. And that's what truth is, the journey there. Yeah?
Right. What do you think of that?
That's beautiful. That's beautiful. How much is fear so inherent to that process? How much is fear so inherent to spirituality? Like, can there really, and has there ever been one that was successfully free?
Let's move this a little closer this way.
Because I think of spiritual practices and narratives, a lot of them are associated very deeply with fear of something. Maybe maybe the shift in different narratives is a shift of what's worth being afraid of.
And I think that's very, very good. I think that sometimes I get worried with the battle between good and evil, the battle between fear and love, because I think that balance is absolutely necessary, and we cannot get rid of fear because it is an important part of our lives, but we also can't let that overrun our lives. We have to, and I feel like we have a lot more fear in our culture than we have love, and it needs to come into a balance. And I think that it's hard to, I don't know how you would extinguish all fear, because with fear we grow stronger. There's a deck in the tarot that is the moon card, and it says the path to enlightenment comes only when we walk through the forest of our darkest fears, and that there's a benevolent force that guides us through that. So I like that. I think that's beautiful.
Right.
So does that answer what your question?
Could. Yeah, because
it's a hard one.
No, it's a good.
I certainly don't know.
It's a big issue, right? Because anything we're overcoming, we have to allay the fear. We have to justify why it's not a problem anymore.
Yeah.
Like, a lot of old stagnant fear is out of, like, the sense of, a word went out one time, like, there's a problem, oh no. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the way that exploited is once that problem isn't there anymore, still acting as if there is. Mm-hmm. But we're just talking about it. Say, one of the issues of capitalism mm-hmm. is it's made to put us into survival mode significantly after, before survival isn't the issue exactly literally.
Okay.
Like, survival becomes a euphemism for storing and hoarding resources for later, because that's our long-term survival.
Yeah.
And there's something deep and intelligent about that.
Yeah.
What's a more responsible way of relating to that?
Huh. Well, I suppose that I guess we need to start seeing when it goes away from our necessity and from our needs and into a sort of addiction, like all the other addictions we have. You can store for the future, because that's a natural animal instinct. I don't know if it's naturally humans. I don't know if we will ever know, but that makes sense. But that doesn't mean that you can go out of control. It becomes an addiction like everything else. And it's a way to hide from fear, to accumulate wealth and power. You're hiding from what you're afraid of instead of trying to... My friend and I were discussing how we thought it was really important to learn to love your fear, because you can't get... It's unrealistic to get rid of it completely, but if you can come and you can be okay with it and accept it, and somehow, I mean, ironically, somehow, love it, then that's right. The best you could do, I think.
Right. There's a certain cautionary history of idealists who realized how much the fear was an illusion
mm-hmm.
and abandoned all fear and stepped into traffic or jumped out of windows.
Sure.
The classic acid, specter
is
forgetting our limits to our detriment,
yeah.
neglecting things that were authentic limits. And I think that's a lot of the fear of radical activism and radical alternative situations, is the sense that we could lose everything in that.
Yeah.
What's a way of identifying helpful solutions versus dangerous ones or threatening ones?
I'm going to go back to tarot cards. I've been reading tarot cards all day, so they're in my head. There's a tarot card called The Fool, and it represents... There's a picture of a man on the rider deck, and he's a traveler. He's got a bindle on his back. He's got a flower in his hand. There's a little dog at his heels, and he's looking up at the sky, and he looks so happy. And he's so... He's full of zest and childish hope and all of that sort of just exuberance that children have. But if you look down in the picture, he's walking off a cliff.
Right.
So you might know the card. And so to me, that says that we can contain that zest for life and that vitality and that love and that all of those things that we need in order to have a movement, but to also make sure we're not taking that out of control. We're not taking it to a point when it no longer becomes our truth. And I think if we, I honestly, I don't know how to do that. I'm trying to figure it out every day. But if we're just trying to, and it's not even being realistic, that doesn't even work. It's just following your intuition and knowing when something is right. And when something's not, you know? So I don't know, just listening to yourself, your lunar internal wisdom, feminine archetype inside yourself. I don't know. Something like that. I'm working on it.
Yeah.
Every day I'm working on it.
Yay for process.
Yeah, process is the best thing we can do. I don't know. As long as we never start believing that we truly know the truth and always seek it, I think that's what I'm going to do.
Cheers.
Cheers, yeah.
So I'd like to introduce you to my friend here.
Okay.
Hello.
Hi.
I love that.
Good,
I could buy your soul.
Yeah. This is Andy Dixon.
Andy Dixon? Mm-hmm. Andy Dixon.
And your name?
Chelsea.
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 Nice to meet you, Chelsea.
Nice to meet you as well.
I will. Thanks, Joe.
You should listen to this, too, my friend.
Keep it up, okay? Yeah.
But before you go. So Andy spent 27 years of an illegal life without parole sentence.
You spent, wait, say it again?
27 years in prison. With an illegal life without parole sentence.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what did you learn?
Well, I learned that anger does you no good. Hate is an illusion, and love's the only way. You gotta love your way out of it.
That is exactly how I feel.
You gotta love your way in it and out of it. You know.
That's beautiful.
Hate gets you into trouble. Love gets you out.
It's funny how we all seem to learn the same lesson.
Mm-hmm.
No matter what we do.
How did you learn that in prison? I thought that lesson in prison was like, be mean and selfish to be strong and get by, no?
That lesson can be learned also. But if you're willing to seek truth, truth will, you know, just come out and dance for you, you know? So.
That's beautiful.
Cheers.
That's wonderful.
Thank you.
Wait, I need to take a picture of you.
Oh.
That's beautiful, man.
Let me get him, too.
Andy Dixon,
huh? Uh-huh. Well, and we have a website for him, too.
IamConvicted.com. Oh, yeah.
How'd you get out?
I'm here.
How'd you get out?
The Supreme Court, unanimous decision. Wow. So sometimes the law works.
Did you testify? I did.
And I was my own lawyer. You know, I had to learn the law. Wow. It takes a long time to learn the law when you didn't even know how to read and write when you went in. So you have to learn things.
My hero.
And then when I got out after 27 years, this guy taught me about technology, because when I went in, the microwave had just been invented. So I come out, and then they got these gadgets, you know.
Oh, yeah, I got one of those crazy.
You know,
you just got out recently.
Well, I've been out 6 years.
6 years.
But, I mean, it's been a really huge learning curve, you know, just to try to figure everything out.
Do you feel like you would somewhat in some ways?
Yeah.
Great. Good talking with you. Okay if I use this?
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
An email to reach you out?
ZakifKafifim@gmail.com. ZakifKafifim@gmail.com.
Okay, great.
All right.
Great. Good talking with you.
So until you do your inner work. True.
Yeah, I agree.
True.
It's
very nice meeting you, Chelsea.
Yeah, you too. Are you going to be here for a while?
I am, and okay. I'd love to do a little 5-minute piece for I Am Convicted, if you wouldn't mind.
Oh, of course, yeah.
And let
sure.
us know what your convictions
sure,
are.
Sure,
because,
sure.
you know, he coined the phrase ex-con with convictions.
I love that. That's great. I love that. What's your name again?
My name is Gio.
Gio. Like, how do you spell that?
G-E-O.
Gio, okay.
And your name?
Chelsea,
any email to reach you at, Chelsea?
Yeah, do you want me to write it down for you?
No, I just want you to tell me so I have
it. Oh, you have it. It's ChelseaWeberSmith@gmail.com. I'll spell it. If you
right.
want. ChelseWeberSmith@gmail.com.
Okay, and this is, you can find Andy Dixon, ex-con with convictions, through socialsculptures.com,
okay.
and then there's some other of my website.
Got it, okay.
And send me an email and remind me you were Occupy Your Soul.
Okay.
Let me just get a close up of that.
This is
the sign? Yeah.
Bless you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Let me get a picture of the young guy.
Same thing we're talking about, right? The same thing.
I wouldn't mind getting one of them myself.
Yeah, people like this one.
Great. Great. Thank you, Chelsea.
Oh, of course. Thank you very much. Great. This is a great thing you're doing. This is fabulous.
Well, let me get back to it.